I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Professor Daphne Koller, co-founder of Coursera, a company that offers online courses to the public through partnerships with leading universities internationally. Coursera was launched in 2012 and reached its first 1 million users faster than Facebook or Twitter. Coursera is one of a number of companies offering massive open online courses, or MOOCs, that have been launched in recent years to address a growing global population and the rising costs of on-campus higher education. Daphne is a professor of computer science at Stanford University. Welcome.
Thank you, Jessica. It's a pleasure to be here.
What are some specific features of a Coursera experience?
So the Coursera student experience is an attempt on our part to give to students all over the world an experience that is as close as possible that we can get to being on campus. The course starts on a given day. Every week the students are responsible for learning some content. There's homework that's due every week, which is graded. And if you don't do your homework, you don't get a grade and you don't pass the course. And then there's a rich social community of students around the course that are working together to help themselves deal with the challenges of this difficult material.
What is the age range of the people enrolled on the system?
We have students that are as young as 10 and students that are as old as 90. I got an email from an 86-year-old that tells us that she doesn't feel comfortable going to college because people are going to look at her funny. What's this old lady doing in class? And so she is taking a Coursera course and meets up with a bunch of other octogenarians every week in the public library to do a study group.
And how about internationally? You're touching students in several hundred countries.
We're touching students in every single country around the world. I mean, every single country that the State Department defines as a country has Coursera students in it. We have students in Iran, we have students in Pakistan, we have students in Ghana and Kenya and South Africa, students in Australia, Chile, Argentina, Brazil, China. I mean, you name it. So just a couple weeks ago, I got an email from the modern contemporary American poetry professor at Penn who told us about a student from Pakistan who had taken the course remotely and has done so well that it was part of his admissions package to Penn, and now he's coming to study at the University of Pennsylvania. We have a student from Peru who took a bunch of our computer science courses because there weren't a lot of computer science courses available to him in Peru, used that as the basis for his Fulbright application, and is now coming to study in the United States as a Fulbright scholar.
You co-founded the company with Professor Andrew Ng, who is also at Stanford. Stanford has a history of computer-assisted learning that, you know, dates back to, I'd say, the 1960s. Can you describe the nature of the computer-assisted learning?
Mm-hmm. So Stanford has a very long history of distance learning. It started out, I think, as you said, back in the 60s, where they were filming courses in class and then shipping literal video cassettes to local industry sites so that students could watch the video cassettes, and then they would mail in their homework and their graded homework would be mailed back to them. This is how long back this goes.
When you say students, these were students actually at local companies in Palo Alto, such as Intel.
That's right. These are students who are local or not even local. Some of them were in Oregon, for example.
And they were employees of these companies.
These were employees of these companies.
And Coursera is also videos of the professors, of the lectures, but it's much more interactive this time.
Well, that's one of the differences. But the other difference is that the lectures are not, by and large, lecture capture of what happens in a live classroom. These are videos that are prepared intentionally for online consumption. And that changes the student experience dramatically because once you move away from the constraints of in-class teaching, you have a lot more freedom. So first of all, you don't have to teach at 50-minute segments. You can teach at 8-minute segments that are much better suited to students' attention spans and to the granularity of the topics. You can also do things that are much more creative, like record some stuff in a workshop or out in the field, for example, making things much more alive to students.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Professor Daphne Koller, co-founder of Coursera, a company that offers university-level online courses to the global public. When was the idea for Coursera hatched with you?
If you want to trace my history in Coursera, it actually goes way back before we even thought of Coursera. Yeah. I've been involved in teaching efforts at Stanford ever since I got there and have been interested in the use of technology in teaching all the way back to 2008 or 9, which is when a group of us were summoned to by Stanford administration to just discuss how students could become more engaged with their instructors at Stanford, how you can create more interaction. About 2 months after that meeting, I happened to be at a Google faculty summit where they bring faculty from all over the world to discuss ideas, and I was listening to a talk on YouTube, and it occurred to me that this provided a medium by which we could create really high-quality course content that could be presented to students outside the classroom with a lot of additional engagement beyond just the lecture. And then when students came into class in that precious time when the students and the faculty were actually in the same room at the same time, you could actually talk to each other and do stuff together. Problem solving, creativity, case studies, things like that that we never have time to do in real classes. And for me, that was the first step that eventually morphed into Coursera a few years after that.
Your co-founder, Professor Andrew Ng, also came to online education through his own personal experience. What was that briefly?
So Andrew, back in 2007-2008, started a project that was aimed to take some of Stanford's great content and make it available to the many people who are not privileged enough to have access to Stanford quality education. And so he created a project called Stanford Engineering Everywhere, which took 10 of Stanford's most popular engineering classes, cleaned them up, and put them up on the web for everyone around the world to make use of.
Incidentally, SEE, or Stanford Engineering Everywhere, has reached over 1 million people at this point.
I think it's that effort combined with some of the ideas that I developed in the context of my class at Stanford, that by combining these different ideas is how we arrived at a lot of the vision behind what turned into Coursera. And that really culminated in the fall of 2011 with a grand experiment that Stanford did in which it launched 3 courses and in computer science and made them open to everyone around the world for free. We were expecting an enrollment of a few thousand people in these courses. They were pretty advanced courses in computer science, but within weeks, each of them had an enrollment of 100,000 students or more. I think that opportunity and the magnitude of it is what caused us to effectively put our respective careers on hold, and in my case also my family on hold to a certain extent, and really walk into what has turned out to be an incredibly exciting but also time-consuming endeavor.
Were you and Andrew friends since you were in the same department? Or
actually, Andrew and I had been friends even before he joined Stanford. We even wrote a paper together while I was a very young faculty member at Stanford and he was still finishing up his PhD at Berkeley.
Coursera has partnerships with Stanford, yes, and universities ranging from Princeton to the University of Pennsylvania to a Hebrew University of Jerusalem. And while Stanford's attitude towards using its content has been one of openness, there has been initial concerns about making the university's content available to the public. Some might feel, why should we offer content for free while students who attend our university are paying northwards of $40,000 a year? What do you think has made universities comfortable with adopting Coursera as a partner?
I think universities are realizing that this is a transformation that's coming, and it's coming regardless of whether they engage with this or not. And many universities feel like they would rather be helping to steer the train as opposed to sitting on the sidelines to see where it goes. At the same time, I think that most of the universities, I would argue all of the universities that are working with us, realize that their value proposition to their students is and had better be about more than just offering content. If content is about to become free and ubiquitous, then what they would like to do is to open up more time in the curriculum for this active engagement with students, which is really what distinguishes the best universities.
Right. It's going to have, this change is coming, and whether they want to be friendly to that and part of that and active agents rather than on the defense is what they're up against.
Online education, when we started doing this, was something that was looked upon with a certain amount of skepticism and even disdain by most institutions. And now it's something that every institution realizes that they're going to have to embrace in some form or another. So somebody told me something the other day that I think is very smart. They said that the term blended learning in 10 years is going to sound like the term horseless carriage. There's not going to be any other kind.
So it's not just launching a company, but you really are pioneering an industry to some extent.
I think we are helping to pioneer the first major transformation in the landscape of higher education since the invention of the printing press. If you look at medicine, for example, and you list all of the inventions that occurred in the last 200 years, there's a ton of them. There's antibiotics and orthoscopic surgery and anesthetics. I mean, you can list them and you have pages. What were the big inventions in education and in higher education in the last 200 years? You kind of scratch your head. Whiteboards versus blackboards? PowerPoint? I mean, there really is not very much on that list.
You have raised venture capital from Kleiner Perkins and NEA. And while you are a for-profit company, you certainly have a social mission. You are mindfully Coursera.org versus Coursera.com. Can you elaborate on that decision?
I think both Andrew and I are educators and went into this with the primary goal of offering education to everyone. We went into this as a for-profit company, partially because people told us it's if you're going to become sustainable, this is a way of doing it in a disciplined way. I'm not starting to rely on charitable foundations and encounter donor fatigue. And partly because that was our way of getting enough seed capital to get this going as a viable effort.
Now, regarding the business model, how do you see becoming profitable? Right now, you offer courses free.
Mm-hmm. Well, we intend to continue offering courses for free because once you start charging money, you block access to this to the people who need it the most, the people who can't afford even $5 or don't, in many cases, even have a credit card. So how do you make money if you don't charge for access? Well, so we have a couple of different directions that we're pursuing. One of those is charging for credentialing, and we've recently started to offer this notion of an authenticated credential where a student identifies themselves using a government-issued ID, and then every time that they submit work, they have a biometric profile that allows us to ensure that they are, in fact, participating in the learning process. This is not a super costly thing. You know, average is about $50 per course to participate in that, and we've had quite a good opt-in to that, and it's entirely optional. Second model, which we think is very interesting, is we've had a lot of institutions come to us and say, we would love to be able to offer this course to our students, but we don't have anyone to teach it. Can we take your course, adopt it, wrap around some instructor guidance and facilitation by an instructor who might not be an expert enough to prepare the course, but can still provide help to students as they make their way through it, and all of a sudden our students are now able to graduate with a much richer transcript than they could before. That makes them much more marketable.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Professor Daphne Koller, co-founder of Coursera. We'll hear more from Professor Koller coming up. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Professor Daphne Koller, co-founder of Coursera, a company that offers online courses to the public through partnerships with leading universities internationally. Daphne is a professor of computer science at Stanford University. You're charging a small fee for this verified certificate, but still that precludes a large percent of the population from taking the course. How are you addressing that?
So from day one, we told our engineers this is not going out without a financial aid program. There's a student from Chile, for example, who for family reasons wants to study Huntington's disease, wants to do a PhD, and is taking our Minds and Synapses course so as to be able to improve their application and have a greater chance of being admitted to its PhD program. We have a student from Egypt, a doctor who is studying the nutrition class so that she can better serve the people of her community despite the fact that she gets no support from the Ministry of Health in Egypt. We have a student from Bangladesh who is taking our energy and sustainability course because he realizes only 53% of the citizens of his country have access to electricity, and he's hoping to be able to provide access to electricity to the other half of his country.
Inherent in any companies getting off the ground are some problems early on, whether they're technical glitches or plagiarism in your case, or questions surrounding grading. You have adopted, in some circumstances, peer grading, where there's more subjectivity around a paper that might be submitted. A student has to grade four other papers, and it's anonymous, so they don't know who the participant is. Can you talk about just the nature of that decision?
There are certain types of work that currently computers just can't effectively grade, and that includes designs, for example. It includes essay questions that require deep thinking, causal reasoning, and so on. Computers just can't grade that right now, and certainly not provide useful feedback to the students. And since we wanted to support courses that require that kind of work, we put together this peer grading mechanism. Now, I agree that it's something that has to be designed very carefully. You can't just take a lay student who's learning the material for the first time and tell them, here's another paper, grade it. Mm-hmm. The instructor has to put a lot of thought into creating a what we call a grading rubric, which defines the criteria by which a paper is supposed to be graded and how each of them is to be applied. And those have to be very carefully specified so that the student, even though they're not expert in the material, can take somebody else's paper and say, yes, these 3 points were made, and yes, these 5 references were given, and so on, so that they can provide a robust and reproducible grade for the work.
It's not perfect, but don't let the perfect be the enemy of the good.
Excellent. Exactly so. And actually, let me add to that, that one of our professors from Princeton, Mitch Denier, actually tried out this notion of the perfect being the enemy of the good. He had two of his teaching assistants grade all of the final exams in his sociology course, and it was a hard final exam, and then compared the results from the TA grading to the results of peer grading, and they were very, very well correlated. Mm-hmm. Now, that was a very well-designed grading rubric, and of course, if the grading rubric is not well designed, this is not going to be as good. But for a well designed grading rubric, it's actually pretty darn good.
You mentioned Professor Mitch Denier. He's a sociology professor at Princeton, and he had 40,000 students take his course from over 100 countries. Can you provide more texture to his experience?
Yeah. So Professor Mitch Denier taught one of our earliest, in fact, arguably our earliest humanities course, because it was a very humanitarian sociology class, not a very quantitative one. And he tried this interesting experiment where, in addition to his weekly lecture materials, he also had a weekly video chat with 10 students selected from different countries around the world. So a student from Nepal, from India, from Georgia, the country, from South America. And he says that he learned more from one instance of teaching this class to a global audience than he learned from teaching it for 12 years at Princeton, because at Princeton, every year there is a great discussion, but it's very similar from year to year because the students have very similar backgrounds. Whereas here, in one go, he got such an amazingly broad range of different perspectives.
We alluded to this before, but can you provide more examples of the types of people taking the Coursera courses, from the traditional student to the octogenarian?
Sure. So our courses span the range of ages. So I mentioned that we have 10-year-olds. There was our algebra instructor from UC Irvine said she went into the park one day and there were a group of 10-year-olds playing, and they came and said, oh, you're the Coursera lady. It's so great to meet you. We're taking your algebra class. And they all hugged her. So that's one example. We have some less happy stories, I guess, of people who don't normally have access. So one example is a student who is a 17-year-old boy who's severely autistic. His name is Daniel, and he has been in special ed his entire life. I should say he has a speaking vocabulary of about 150 words, but he types on an iPad and is able to communicate very effectively with a very rich vocabulary. And he was the star student in the University of Pennsylvania Modern Contemporary American Poetry class, and he says this is the first meaningful educational experience that he's had after a life of special ed.
What's another example?
Yeah. So a couple months ago, we got an email from a woman who happens to be a Stanford alumna and has stage 4 breast cancer. And she says that she can't really leave the house except to go to the hospital to get her chemotherapy, and that this class is her one window into the outside world. Hmm. We have one of our earliest story is a father of an immune-suppressed baby who couldn't leave the house because his baby was getting immune treatment therapy, and he was bone marrow transplant, and he was afraid that if he would leave the house, he would bring in germs to infect her. And so he spent the time while there taking some of our courses and learning more about computer science, and ultimately ended up getting an internship in a database company and the strength of that.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Daphne Koller, co-founder of Coursera, an online education company launched in April 2012. Its goal is to provide the global public with access to a university-level education that has previously been unavailable on a wide scale. Coursera has partnerships with more than 60 global universities, including Stanford, Northwestern, University of Pennsylvania, and the University of Tokyo. Some people look at the disruption of the online education space and draw the analogy or the parallel to journalism and newspapers, how you had all this valuable content that was being undercut when digitalization came. Journalists' skilled work was being given away for free. And what do you see as a parallel industry or a parallel disruption?
So I think that, you know, digitalization is something that transforms an industry. It creates new leaders and it creates new job categories and opens doors that were closed before. So let's take, for example, electronic commerce. Certainly, it created a consolidation of a number of key marketplaces like Amazon and eBay, where a lot of sellers are now congregating together with a lot of buyers to create a marketplace that is actually very efficient. In some ways, it enabled things that were local mom-and-pop shops that had only a very small local audience, if they were efficient and forward-thinking, to all of a sudden reach out to people around the country. So when we were redoing our kitchen, I ended up buying a bunch of doorknobs from a mom-and-pop shop in Florida. So I think that this really creates opportunities as it also transforms the entire sector.
We're talking about disruption, and we're so at the early stages, it's hard to know what the long-term impacts of some of these are, but we have cell phone usage that is rampant. What changes are going on even biologically with our brain circuitry, you know, as a result of our usage of social media all the time? And I wonder if are the changes in our brains, are if those changes are making online education perhaps maybe not better distribution platforms than traditional education, but have you thought about that marriage?
Well, I think that there's a lot of changes that are occurring in today's young people that make this in many ways a better dissemination platform for them.
For better or worse.
For better or worse. So I think the fact that people are so used to consumption of content via digital media is making them much more open to getting content in this way. And the fact that we're able to make that content sort of shorter time span, much more intensive, much more interactive is a lot more commensurate with how they react to other content in their lives. At the same time, I think we're also leveraging on the fact that they're used to getting so much of their interaction via digital media. I have two daughters. They're 8 and 10. They sit in adjacent rooms texting each other. I mean, they could play together physically, but they like texting each other. They like texting me. So I think that people today are actually much more receptive and interested in participating with each other via digital media, and we're capitalizing on that.
You are acquiring a lot of data. You're seeing how people are learning. What are some interesting nuggets of information that you've gleaned from the number of people taking these courses? Whether you've incorporated this feedback into the company is another matter.
Yeah. So I think one of the biggest opportunities that we have here is to take the study of human learning and turn it from an anecdotal science into a data science, because the amount and quality of the data that we're getting is just unbelievable. So you can start to look at, for example, which are effective mechanisms for pedagogy in an online format and which aren't. So, for example, in collaboration with a group at Stanford, we tested the question of whether showing the instructor's face in the video is a good thing or a bad thing. There's people who say that it distracts from the content and people that say that it humanizes the experience. And I wish I could tell you what worked better, but I can't, because the students who weren't seeing the instructor's face complained bitterly that they were unable to focus because it wasn't sufficiently engaging. And so the experiment had to be stopped in the middle. So I think that at least here is something where we know what the students think they want. If it's actually more effective, I don't know, but it's certainly what the students think they want.
What's another example?
So a very preliminary example that we did is, does sending students email telling them that a deadline is tomorrow and that they better log on and do their homework, does that increase or decrease student retention? You would think that it would increase student retention. It turns out that the answer is a little bit more nuanced. If you just send students an email telling them that their homework is due tomorrow, they feel like they're being nagged, and it actually decreases retention. The email needs to be much more carefully constructed with something that tells them not only that their homework due, but they're really doing well in the course, they're 80% along in the course, and kind of something that encourages them at the same time.
The global footprint of Coursera is vast, but can you break that down? Can you provide some more stories?
When my class was first offered on Coursera, I got an email from a student who lives on the Afghan-Pakistani border in a war zone, who told me that he had to leave school after a year to go support his family, but he really wanted to take my class and was wondering if I could offer him a scholarship. And I told him that I didn't need to offer him a scholarship because it was free. And he said, "Really? So can I take two classes?" And I said that, yes, of course he could take two classes. And then he wrote me back to say that he promises to repay my faith in him by going down to the internet cafe in his village, which is the only place that he has an internet connection, so that he would be able to do his homework every week. So that's one example. We have a student in Kazakhstan who took a number of our courses and ended up, on the strength of that, being able to get a job at Twitter in Kazakhstan. He's now working remotely. We have a group of students in Iran who, there's serious network connectivity issues there. Not everyone has access to the internet. So my colleague Andrew Ng was told by one student that the student was downloading all of his lectures and burning them on DVDs to distribute them to people around the country so they would have access to lecture material, for example, even if they didn't have internet access.
What about in Ohio or someplace in the United States?
Yeah. There's a group in Ohio that has formed where a wonderful, wonderful woman took a group of students who by and large had very little college education but had a lot of motivation. And she put them together in a community center. They met once a week and they took the University of Virginia Darden course on Grow to Greatness. And she sent me a picture of the group. And, you know, it's people by and large in their 40s who've had a very difficult life. They work all the time and yet they carve time out of their schedule to try and learn something new and become and have a better life as a consequence of that.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Professor Daphne Koller, co-founder of Coursera, a company that offers university-level online courses to the global public. Coursera is one of a number of companies offering massive open online courses, or MOOCs, that had been launched in recent years to address a growing global population and the rising costs of on-campus higher education. You are from Israel, and you come from a family of academics. Your father was a botanist, and your mother taught English as a second language. I'm kind of curious about your father's botany. Do you have an interest in botany?
No, I don't. I think my father was disappointed that neither of his children expressed an interest in botany. But interestingly, my father's story is that he really wanted to be an engineer. And he even started out studying to be an engineer, but he was told at the time, Israel is a very young country, that the thing Israel needed most was not engineers, but rather agriculture. So he went from being an engineer to being to working in botany, which is the basis for Israeli agriculture. But I think throughout his life, he was a bit of a frustrated engineer, and the part that he enjoyed as much as anything was building all sorts of cool measurement devices for his plants. And so I think that in retrospect, my father and I had a lot more parallels than our different paths in life suggested.
Right. Israel, obviously,'s land is quite arid, and they've had to be very resourceful in growing its food. And
that's right. But I think the funny part is that now, of course, Israel's biggest industry is, in fact, its engineering and high-tech industry, and my father was just born at the wrong time.
Did you serve in the Israeli army?
Yes, I did. I was a lieutenant in military intelligence.
This was in the 1980s? Or
yes.
Did you read Startup Nation and how Israel is more entrepreneurial because of the military experience that they have?
Oh, that's absolutely true. I mean, Israel is more entrepreneurial because of the military experience. I think it takes young people and puts them into a position where they have a really significant mission that they're trying to live up to. It's resource constrained, and you're supposed to make do with what's available. You take a person, you say, you have to do this. There isn't much money. There isn't a lot of equipment for you to do it with, but do it anyway.
What's an example of that resourcefulness?
The examples that I know are all classified. Sorry.
You are the Rajiv Motwani Professor of Computer Science at Stanford, and Rajiv was an advisor to a number of startups in Silicon Valley, including Google. Actually, Google endowed this professorship.
Endowed chair.
After Professor Motwani died. Did you have interactions with Professor Motwani when you were...
Professor Motwani was actually on the faculty at Stanford when I joined as a graduate student back in 1989. When I came back to Stanford as faculty back in 95, we were actually in that same research group from which Larry Page and Sergey Brin emerged and created Google. It was part of the Digital Libraries group at Stanford, and a lot of the early discussions around how to rank web pages occurred in the context of that group. So I've known Larry and Sergey since they were back when they were still graduate students at Stanford. Rajiv was a tremendously gifted individual, and was, I think, one of his greatest strengths was his ability to bridge the theory and the practice. I think that that was a part of his ability to help guide people like Larry and Sergey into areas that would make so much impact. And the chair that is endowed in his name is intended to be for people who similarly bridge between theory and practice. And I'm very privileged to be able to hold that chair. It's a real honor.
Well, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
My guest has been Daphne Koller, co-founder of Coursera. Coming up, we'll hear from Fred Swanaker, founder of African Leadership Academy, a school focused on training Africa's future leaders. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Fred Swanaker, founder of African Leadership Academy, an institution that's dedicated to developing Africa's next generation of leaders. The school admits students from across Africa and is committed to encouraging graduates to stay in Africa. Fred founded African Leadership Academy in 2004 when he was 27 years old. He's a graduate of McAllister College in Minnesota and has an MBA from Stanford Business School. Welcome.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
You lived in over four countries before you were 18 years old. Why did your family keep moving?
You see, Ghana had an excess supply of skilled labor. And so other countries in Africa, as they were developing, would come to Ghana to look for professionals like lawyers and teachers and doctors. And my dad was a magistrate and my mother was a teacher. So they were recruited by different countries in Africa to come and work in their civil service. So that's how we moved around.
You did your primary and secondary schooling in Africa, and then you went to McAllister College in Minnesota. What was the thinking behind that?
My mother had been to graduate school in Minnesota. And so when I was growing up, I used to look at pictures in her album, and I would see pictures of her, you know, in the snow. McAllister is also known in Ghana and Africa because that's where Kofi Annan, the former Secretary General of the United Nations, went to college.
Did you have the intention of definitely returning, or was there part of you that thought, oh, you know what, maybe I'll stay put in the United States?
No, you see, one thing that all these experiences of living and working in different parts of Africa did is it made me very passionate about being an African. Mm-hmm. So most people who grew up in Africa only know the country that they were born in. In fact, their perceptions of the rest of the continent is what they see on CNN. I had seen that there was tremendous beauty in Africa and tremendous potential, that we were really the next frontier of development.
What did you think were the key ingredients to helping with Africa's development?
When I look at the history of Africa, we've been through different phases of development. You had the period in the 60s, which was the independence era. You know, African countries breaking away from the shackles of colonialism and gaining their political independence. And then you moved into phase two, which was the period of real political instability. Then phase three, which is more stability. And there's more semblance of democracy. And when, you know, a change of government happens by force, it's seen as an exception now rather than the rule it was 20 years ago. The thing that's left to be done in Africa now, I believe, and this was my perception when I was graduating from McAllister College, was to create prosperity and to eradicate poverty. So the first job I got out of college was with McKinsey, mm-hmm. the consulting firm. Mm-hmm. I wanted to understand business. I wanted to see how business was being done in Africa. And that was how I began my journey of understanding, you know, what we needed to do to bring this next phase of change to Africa.
There have only been like a handful of leaders that have helped to transform African society, ranging from, you know, Nelson Mandela to Desmond Tutu. Why do you think Africa has kind of such a scarcity of leadership?
See, when Ghana got independence in 1957, there was something like 18,000 university graduates in the whole of sub-Saharan Africa, if you exclude South Africa from the picture. Countries like the DRC, the Democratic Republic of Congo, had four university graduates in 1957. So imagine the independence era arriving in Africa in the late 50s and early 60s. When Kenneth Kaunda was forming his cabinet in Zambia, you know, he had four university graduates to work with. And so that's the state at which Africans found themselves in the first set of leaders who took over the continent.
Your mother started a school in Botswana, and you, at age 18, became the headmaster of that school. Why did you become the headmaster of the school?
My mother had, was a really great teacher. And so the parents approached her and said, you know, would she set up a school for them? But she had no experience raising money. My dad had just passed away.
He died of high blood pressure and hypertension. Basically had a heart attack, yeah.
So she didn't have any financial resource of her own, and she had to look after four kids. So she said, look, I can't quit my job as a teacher and start the school for you. What I will do is I'll start a study group. And then it grew, more and more kids came, and then the next thing was 20 kids and then 25 kids. And then I had finished high school, and I had a year to wait before I went to college. And so my mother said, you know, why don't you run the school for me? And so for a year, I was the headmaster. I taught some classes. I managed some of the teachers and dealt with the parents. And in the afternoons, I'd go and meet with her and we'd discuss the strategy for the next day. And today, that school is one of the top performing primary schools in Botswana.
And it's called Mount Pleasant English Medium School.
Exactly. And it has about 300 children.
Did you think, you know, during that year that, you know what, I'd like to make a career out of being the headmaster of a school?
Absolutely not. I had no idea that one day I'd be back in education and in leadership development. You know, I saw my future as a businessman.
So here you were. You were at McKinsey, and then you decided to go to Stanford Business School. And McKinsey paid for your education at Stanford Business School, about $125,000. And you were supposed to return to McKinsey, but instead you decided to start African Leadership Academy. What was the catalyst for saying, you know what, there is a scarcity of leaders in Africa, I'm going to start ALA rather than return to McKinsey?
So in between my first and second year at Stanford, as most MBA students do, I had to find an internship. Given that I was supposed to go back to McKinsey after my MBA was finished, I thought, let me just do something interesting. So there was an opportunity to go and work in Nigeria to help set up a microfinance institution. Mm-hmm. And I went to Nigeria, and in the course of that, I met these wealthy families who were complaining to me about the fees they were paying to send their, you know, children to expensive boarding schools in the UK, and they were paying about $50,000 a year to send them there. So I was thinking, wow, why are we paying so much money to send young people to these schools in the UK? Why don't we have the best education institutions in Africa that can keep them on the continent? Because I was worried that these young people that were leaving were the future leaders of Africa. So that's when the light bulb went off, and I said, you know, why don't I actually build this institution? And so I said, you know what, I need to find a way to pay this $120,000 off to McKinsey and really do this. I didn't know where I was going to get the $120,000 from, but when I graduated, I called McKinsey and said, you know, I'm not coming back.
How did you raise the $120,000 to pay them back?
I had borrowed some money from my mom. Mm-hmm. And then also I had raised some money to start ALA from my friends and family, and part of that was the salary I was going to pay myself. And so what I did is I took the salary that I was going to pay myself and gave it to McKinsey.
Mm-hmm.
So then I had no salary to live on for the next 2 years.
And where were you living at the time?
In Johannesburg.
So what was it like having no salary? What did that mean daily?
It meant daily I didn't know where my meals were going to come from, where I would get money to buy clothes from, and, you know, other basic things that people who have a salary take for granted. So I had to become creative in terms of the way I lived. My friends would buy me lunch, you know, so I made sure that I always had a lunch appointment with a friend.
Uh-huh. Where did you live?
I slept on people's couches and, you know, friends' cottages in the backyards, mm-hmm. and those kinds of things.
Your mother, as we discussed, was an educator. What was her perspective?
She thought I was crazy, even though she had done it herself. She hadn't done it, I guess, in such a risky manner.
Her name's Edna, and she eventually gave you $100,000, which, by the way, have you given back to her, or was it more of a gift?
Well, it's something I was meant to pay back, but I think over time she's forgiven the loan.
Ah, it's a forgivable loan.
Exactly.
I see. So here you are sleeping on friends' couches and having people buy you lunch. Was there one or two people in the early days that really helped to, you know, get the academy off the ground or to make the idea of the academy more of a reality?
Yes, definitely. I mean, they were my partners, my co-founders. You know, one was a man called Chris Bradford, who I had met when I was at business school, and then my two former bosses from McKinsey. Mm-hmm. We initially raised about $200,000.
And then you were looking to raise $7 million, and the bulk of that came from a woman named Rebecca Capizio. Why was Rebecca interested in African Leadership Academy?
We set out on a search for a possible campus. And we went to this area just outside of Johannesburg called the Cradle of Humankind, which is where some of the oldest human remains have been found. It's a very beautiful setting. And there was a conference center there that we approached and said, you know, can we rent this conference center and use it for our academy? And they said, you know, sorry, we're fully utilized, but why don't you go next door? There's a property there. There was a manager at the farmhouse, and we kind of shared what we were trying to do. And he said, you know, we don't have a space there that's big enough for you to use for your campus, but the owner of this property is very interested in education. Hmm. So why don't you send us something and we'll send it to the manager, to the owner. And we didn't know that the owner was this woman, Rebecca Capizio, who comes from the Oppenheimer family that owns De Beers in South Africa.
De Beers, the Diamond Empire.
The Diamond Empire, exactly. So we sent her a one-page description of what we were trying to do, and she wrote back and said, you know what, I don't have a facility that you can use, but I like this idea so much that I'm willing to build it for you.
Huh.
And we thought, wow, does she really know who we are? I mean, just from a paragraph, she's willing to commit. You know, does she know how much money we would need? So then we said, you know, okay, we're coming to Seattle in a few weeks, can we come and meet with you?
Because she was living in Seattle at the time.
Exactly. That's why she wasn't at her property when we visited. Mm-hmm. And so we went and met with her, and you know, we said, look, this is going to cost us about $5 million to build it. Are you willing to commit this money? And she said, yeah. And that changed everything.
Do you remember that specific moment? Were you in her house when she talked to you about it?
We're sitting in a lobby in a hotel in Seattle, and she had come with her husband, and I was there with Chris. When we met her, it was kind of a surreal experience. You know, we were these 27-year-old guys with just an idea on a piece of paper.
Incidentally, in addition to Rebecca Capizio, another woman was pretty instrumental to you in the early days, and that was the former CEO of Hewlett-Packard, Carly Fiorina, mm-hmm. who had gone to high school randomly in Ghana. Mm-hmm. How did she help you?
At this time, I didn't know how to raise money. I had been to visit the dean at the Stanford Business School to ask him for advice on how to raise money. And one of his pieces of advice to me was that you should never ask for money in your first meeting with someone. So this is our first meeting with Carly Fiorina. And, you know, we had lunch with her. And then at the end, she said, okay, so why did you want to meet with me today?
Mm. And meanwhile, you have his advice in your ear.
I had his advice in my ear. I said, don't ask her for money. So I said, well, you know, perhaps you could help us with your relationships in the technology world to help us get some computers for our school. And he said, okay, fine, I'm happy to do that. And then she said, and I said, well, you know, maybe you could also help us build relationships with the South African government. And she said, yeah, sure, I'm happy to do that. And then she said, is there anything else? And so at this point, I'm sitting there thinking, okay, she, you know, she's asking us if we need money. But the dean of Stanford said, don't ask for money on your first meeting. So Chris is kicking me under the table saying, you know. So then eventually I was like, well, we're also looking to raise money and, you know, perhaps you could contribute. 3 months later, she gave us $100,000.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Fred Swanaker, founder of African Leadership Academy, a school focused on training Africa's future leaders. How did you encourage applicants? How did you encourage people to come?
We had, you know, surveyed parents. We had talked to headmasters of other schools in Africa, had asked them about the concept that we were proposing, and, you know, the feedback was generally quite positive. But we had never actually spoken to young people. And if you think about it, they were the client base, the customers, in a way. So 2007, we said, oh, actually, no, we're opening our doors a year from now. We need to start recruiting our first class. So we hired a team of people, and we went around and started visiting schools. And we did a mailing to about 2,000 schools. And we were shocked when the deadline arrived and we had received 1,700 applications from 35 countries for our first class. And there were only 100 places available.
Who were some students who really impressed you? You're like, wow, I want this student in my school.
One of the things we asked in the application form, we said, tell us about a time you identified a need in your community. Mm-hmm. And what did you do about it? And so Belinda's application, she talked about how she was lived in a suburb of Harare in Zimbabwe. And every day she used to see these three kids coming around and begging for food. And so she approached them and to find out why they were begging. And it turned out that their parents had died from AIDS. And so she decided that she wanted to do something about this to help them so they could stop begging. And she had been learning agriculture at school and was learning how to raise chickens. So she asked her mom for, you know, like about a couple of dollars and used that to buy a couple of chickens that could lay eggs. And she built this chicken business. And with that, she was able to generate enough income that she was able to feed this family of three, these three kids. And then she taught the kids how to look after the chickens and also how to grow a vegetable farm and so on. And soon they were able to look after themselves completely independently, and they were able to have enough funding that the oldest child could now go to school. And she did all this by herself when she was 16, 17.
You created from the start a financial incentive for your graduates to stay put in Africa. How does that work?
The vast majority of the young people that we admit to the academy cannot afford to pay the fees. So we give them scholarships. It costs about $25,000 per child for 1 year. We don't give them that scholarship as a grant, but as a forgivable loan. And so when they graduate from the two-year program and go into college, that loan continues accruing interest. So all we ask is that they return to Africa by the age of 25 and stay and serve the continent for 10 years. They can do whatever they want to do in Africa. And if they don't return, or if they leave at some point before they're 10 years old, then they have to repay that loan with interest. Mm-hmm. There's a model like this in Singapore and in Thailand. There's a school called Raffles Junior College, and they have a 97% return rate.
African Leadership Academy aims to develop the next generation of leaders. What does that mean practically or daily?
A big part of this development is what we call giving them practice in leadership. So while they're at the academy, they all have to do what's called a culminating project, where they either have to launch a business or launch a social venture in the community. And what we're trying to do there is to simulate the kind of experience that Mark Zuckerberg had in his dorm room at Harvard when he started Facebook. So over the last few years, we've launched about 42 different ventures, ranging from a bank that operates on our campus to a farm on the campus to a clothing store to sustainable community agricultural projects that have all been spearheaded by these young people. And we have a venture fund on our campus that invests in them. And our aim there is to really give them the taste of being an entrepreneur and being a leader in real time and real life. And we believe that if you give them this defining experience at that age, it gives them the foundation and the passion to go on and do entrepreneurial ventures and to be leaders on a much bigger scale later on in their lives. If I hadn't had this experience when I was 18, running my mother's school, I don't think I would have had the confidence or the experience to one day do what I'm doing today with ALA, which is on a much bigger scale. And if you look back, a lot of entrepreneurs, Richard Branson, when he was 15, 16, was selling magazines. And that prepared him to go and launch Virgin one day. And so it's the same kind of practice and leadership that we like, that we spend a lot of time trying to give these young leaders. And then the other thing we're doing is exposing them to a network of mentors and potential advisors and people who can open doors for them as they go through different stages of their lives.
So what's an example?
There's a young man from the Democratic Republic of Congo. He's a refugee. He came to ALA on a scholarship, and while he was there, we had a guest speaker who visited campus. And this woman is involved in using theater as a way to help victims of trauma. Joseph was so struck by her talk that he said, you know, I really want to go and replicate this in my refugee camp. And in the process, the woman also got so involved that she helped him raise $20,000, and he used that to build the first high school in his refugee camp. And that's all happened because of that network that was struck, that conversation that happened when this woman visited campus to be a speaker.
Well, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
My guest has been Fred Swanaker, founder of African Leadership Academy.
If you'd like to learn more about the show, please visit our website at fromscratchradio.com or follow us on Twitter at Jess G. Harris or find us on Facebook. Our website is fromscratchradio.org. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch.